Coming up on Boston Public Radio, a growing number of local tech firms are offering workers unlimited vacation time, and you won't believe how much time these workers are taking off. Pilot Patrick Smith answers all your questions on air travel 2013. Fun or terror or a deal? And Boston Globe King of Curmudgeon columnist Alex Beam sits in on open mic for his vacationing boss, Brian McGrory.
And daffodils are being planted all along the Boston Marathon route from Hopkinton to Boston. We'll find out who's behind that. And if you find yourself loving your dog or a baby more than you do actual adults, we're going to find out what makes you tick around that. So stay tuned. We'll have all that and more on Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell, co-publisher of Bay Windows, is here again to fill in for the vacation.
Feeling pretty good, isn't it, Marjorie?
I think we're a tandem.
I think it works
pretty
well.
I think we've got a chemistry here going on, don't you think?
We do.
Back and forth. Well, thank you very much for filling in for Jim Browdy. It's been great. Jim will be back next week. So there is this, I mean, it is August, as everybody knows.
Yes.
Lots of us are on vacation. And there's this new trend, particularly among these local tech firms. A number of them are offering unlimited vacation time. And the result? Workers aren't taking advantage of it. They're not taking the time. In fact, they're taking fewer days off than when they had fixed vacation 2 weeks, 3 weeks a year. So our question to you guys at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970 is the notion of time off a real vacation no longer an option? Because we have this fluid working world now where you can work from home, has that ruined taking a break from work? Are you one of those people who wouldn't take extra time even if you had it? And I really want to know, is this about loving your job or about pressure to keep up with the workaholics around you at the office? You know, like a cynical plot by the boss, as somebody told me this morning. You give them all this time off and then don't like the people who actually take the time off, relegate them to second-class status around the office. Unlimited time off vacations, people aren't taking the time. What do you think about this? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you think, Sue?
Well, you know, I have I'm a business owner, a small business owner, and I have had, at one time, I had many employees. And because the newspaper business, the media business, is deadline-oriented.
Right.
And it's also, you know, you gotta work to the goal. It's, you don't, if you don't do your story doesn't get done. We know it. It's not like we can't track you. We have always had a very soft vacation policy. We combine.
What does that mean, soft?
Well, what it means is we don't keep track of your days off.
Oh, okay.
We also, I mean, people, if they were going to go away to a European vacation or something, that would be one thing, but they work weekends, they work nights, sometimes they got to get up early to cover a broken water main in the South End. But at the same time, we also eliminated sick time. So you had one chunk of time off. You could have 30 days, say, of time off. That's your vacation.
That's
your sick.
Weeks.
That's your personal.
That's pretty good.
And use it or lose it. It doesn't carry
over.
Is that
6 weeks? What is that, 30 days?
I don't know. It's a lot. 5,
Math
10, 15, 20.
My,
I, you know, I don't remember what it was.
We need Jim here to count the
that's
that
his job.
Long
that's
division.
His job. And no one ever abused it because they had, again, they had deadlines they had to hit. They were also reachable if they weren't in. You know, I'm the type of person, if I go on vacation, if I go to Disney, I like to totally unplug.
Yeah.
I went away for April vacation, hoping to work from a distance. But unfortunately, on a more serious note, we had the marathon bombing, but I still had to work. And it's hard to unplug. It's hard to let someone else do something, too, I think. And
firms. Well, people know that you're reachable 24-7. Right. I mean, they've got you. How many times, even on vacation, how many times does your boss have to call before you feel guilty about not calling back? I would say once.
Once. You know, and early on in my career, I worked for a video production company in the 90s, and they had a similar idea if you just took off what you needed. But, of course, there's always one person who abuses it. You know, one person who, you know, just would take as much time off as possible and not get the work done, and then we needed to have the real vacation policy come in. And I think it's also a very elitist sort of viewpoint. The folks that work at Walmart can't do this. You know, the folks that work at the Stop and Shop can't do this.
Yeah, but they should be able to do it, too. I mean, they should be able to have that flexibility everybody else does. 877-301-8970. Katie Johnston wrote this piece in the front page of the Boston Globe. A lot of these local tech firms, up to 10%, the trend is supposedly growing, are offering people jobs with unlimited vacation time. One guy, boy, this guy was really devoted. It made me sort of nervous. He said, quote, if I take 6 weeks vacation, that's less time I'm here to make change happen.
Yeah, I mean, these people wow. really, you know, these are the type of people who are also very devoted to what they do.
Yeah.
And they might work all night writing code. I mean, I know people who write code and they are a different breed of people. They love it. They get in their little hobbit hole and they write their code. And then when they're done, they're done. So
maybe you can only do this when you're young. No children, no spouse.
Well, might
I think
work
the spouse
with the children,
or the kid
though.
might be a little upset if you never pay any attention to them because you're always working. Have you heard
well, did our parents ever pay any attention to us, even the ones that were working or
no,
not working?
No,
so what do you know?
But the expectation now is you're supposed to show up at these soccer games. You know what I'm saying? It was different back in the ancient times.
We didn't have soccer.
We didn't,
we didn't have games.
We didn't have grass. Okay. 877-301-8970. What do you think about this thesis? You offer your employees unlimited vacation time, particularly in these high-tech local firms, and your workers don't take it. Andrew from Providence. What do you think, Andrew?
You know what? I mean, I run a startup, and I think it's really one of the best ways to build trust with your employees. You know, it's so childish to say, you know, we limit you to taking off here and then, and you have to accumulate your time off days. And just to say, listen, you know, we trust you as a person. We trust that when you need to take time off, you can take time off, whether it be a day here and there or whether it be a 2 week or month long vacation.
Of course, the kicker there is you have to actually hire adults. That's the kicker, Andrew,
right.
Because, you know, and in the tech world, I mean, I think, and Andrew, you can correct me if I'm wrong. You do have a different type of person who's dedicated to hitting the deadline and working. And it's also a great way for a startup to get very talented people at a little lower cost because you're able to offer them a benefit that another company might not be able to.
But it's working for you, Andrew.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, what I've heard and what I think myself is that it really creates that whole it gets rid of that idea that employment is indentured servitude. It mm-hmm. gets rid of that idea that employment is ownership, that your employer owns you. It gives you that flexibility as the employee to sort of feel more free and do better work accordingly.
You know, it's funny. Jeff Coakley, my business partner, and I over at Bay Windows in the South End News, we used to hire people from one other media company all the time. They would leave all burnt out and come to us. And we would always be like, well, there's a storm coming on deadline day, right? There's going to be 42 feet of snow. Let's make a plan so we can work from home or change the deadline. And they would look at us like, well, aren't you going to tell us when we can come in and go home? And we would say to them, Andrew, we would say, you're a grown-up. You can make the decision on your safety. And it was really startling. These were grown-ups, and they were startled that they could be in charge of their own time.
And yeah, I think it fosters that idea of ownership of your own role.
Yeah. Andrew, thank you for the call. You sound like a great boss.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I can't do anything in the high-tech
industry.
No, I'm
going to go right now. I have something to do. I'll be back in about 20 minutes, okay?
Caitlin from Sudbury, what do you think about unlimited vacation time and few employees offered it actually taking it?
Hi. So I actually have unlimited vacation. I just took a week off in Jamaica, which was fabulous.
I bet.
But, you know, that's the only real chunk of time I've taken off. And even while I was there, you know, I still logged into the computer, checked the email, did some work, you know, and I'm in another country. So I think the idea that I don't have, you know, X number of weeks set up is liberating, but at the same time, I feel like if I do take a ton of time off, it's going to look bad.
Yeah.
Caitlin, are you more relaxed during the day? I mean, one of the things that I think happens too when you have unlimited time off is that you're not crazy during the day to get a lot of work. You hit your deadlines and you do what you're supposed to do, but if you need to run out and, you know, go to your kids' play or pick up your dry cleaning, you feel a little more relaxed doing that. Is that true for you?
Yeah, I definitely do. And you know, I do some treatments down at Mass General. And I take about a day every 2 months to do that. But there's never any real kind of pressure to, you know, run back to the office to do everything because I know my schedule and I feel like I'm much more in control of what I need to get done. And it's empowering to know that you have the time if you need it, but I think it makes you want to do the work better.
Caitlin, what kind of work are you in? What kind of field?
I'm actually at a very small insurance firm.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you for the call. Yeah, I think that's true. You worry about taking the, you know, there's that FaceTime issue.
Mm-hmm.
I worry about that because I also work at the Boston Herald.
Yeah, me too. Yep.
I don't go into the office that much anymore because I like my computer system better at home and I frankly get more done at
home.
Me
too, yeah.
But you do worry about that, not actually being in the office to say, here I am, you know, working until the wee hours. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Linda from Blackstone, New Hampshire. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, okay. Is this? Do you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
I'm sorry. My name is Ellen.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ellen.
That's all right. You know, I have been working for myself for 19 years. I've had 2 weeks off in 19 years.
Yeah.
Most of the people in my building who work for themselves, if they're lucky, they can get a week off. And I just want people to think about, you know, because everybody has a little variety store in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you go in there, those people who own that variety store are always working because you make enough money to make a living, but you don't make enough money to hire somebody else so you can take time off.
That's true.
Okay, Linda, so you've worked for 20 years with about 2 weeks off in 20 years. Do you feel deprived or do you feel resentful or is this okay?
You know, it is what it is. I made this decision. I used to work for AT&T. I'd been with them for 18 years. They pulled out of New England totally. I could have kept my job if I was willing to go to Pennsylvania or Arizona, which I was not willing to do because I had my kids in a very good, reasonably priced small private school, and I didn't want to uproot them at that time of their life. So I made a decision to come and do this, and it is what it is. Like I said, I mean, I knew I was never going to make the money ever again what I made for AT&T. Did I work hard? Absolutely. I had to show up even when there was, you know, a national emergency. We had one of those cards that you showed so you could cash.
You're essential employee. You are essential to our
employee.
Safety. Yes.
That's right. So, you know, I got paid vacations there.
Yeah.
They didn't have sick days, but you did get paid if you were out sick. They just didn't call them sick days because mm-hmm. they didn't want people taking, you know, taking advantage of it. But they paid me well.
Yeah.
And anybody who ever worked for AT&T can never say that they weren't paid well
yeah.
because they were a company that paid you well.
Pensions.
And back in the day. They expected, you know, you to do your
right.
job.
Yeah.
Which you should. You're getting paid.
No,
well,
Ellen,
I think you should take tomorrow off. I think you should just unplug and take tomorrow off.
No,
because I know how you feel.
No, because if I don't work, there's no money in our home.
Yep, that's
we live week to week.
Yeah.
Yep.
No, Ellen, thank you for the call. I mean, the small business people
oh, yeah.
and the people who run stuff, it's really hard
if you
run.
I haven't had a day. I mean, I'm no Ellen because I like to take my time off. But I've not had a full unplugged day. Not checking email, not checking, I don't check my voicemail at work, and you all know that, but in a year. I've not had completely no work in a year.
I hate that.
Oh, I hate it too.
I mean, I'm just one little cog in the wheel, so when I'm on vacation, I can be on vacation. But if you're checking your voicemail and
yep.
your email and your text messages all the time, I don't think it's much of a vacation.
No, it isn't. And I think that's – but again, that's the small business owners. That's the mom and pop on the corner.
You know what the irony is, though? Okay, if you grew up in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, people did come home. Even the lawyers
yep.
and the doctors and all that, they did come home. They worked fewer hours.
Yep, and sometimes
and
the store
they
would
they seem to
close.
Have more money, too.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean?
No, it's
there
definitely
was like one person working in the family. Blue collar neighborhoods, you had two people working in the family, but they still did not seem to be working these obsessive hours. I think there's something going on.
And
in
if
the
your
wrong
boss
direction.
Called you at home, it was, you know, the
never
earth
happened.
Was falling apart.
Yeah, never happened. Jennifer from Rhode Island, what do you think about the thesis that a lot of these young high tech firms in Boston, hiring people and giving them unlimited vacation, but many of the workers do not take it?
Well, I think they probably don't take it because they're like the company that I work for. I work for a Fortune 500 company that gives us 6 weeks. And upper management, senior management, always makes comments about when someone does utilize all their weeks, oh, it's abused, or sometimes it's abused. And my thought is, don't give it unless the expectation is that we're going to utilize it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't passively imply that it's somehow abused. If we're using it, you think it's excessive,
mm-hmm.
don't offer it.
Yep,
if you think we're in a high burnout position and we really should have this, or it's a great benefit to get us to take the position
mm-hmm.
with your company,
mm-hmm.
then encourage us to use it.
So Jennifer,
if you
Jennifer,
can't carry it over, you can't take a payout, then say, use your time.
What do you do, Jennifer? Do you take it or not?
I take it.
Yep. You know what I've found, Jennifer?
Good for you.
I take it.
I have found, over the years, I have found, because I used to be one of those employees that I would, you know, other people around me, my peers, would ask for more stuff and get it, and I'd say, I'm not going to ask, so that way I'll be in the perfect position. Now at 51, I can see it doesn't matter whether you take it or not, whether you ask for the extra benefits or not. Everyone gets sort of where they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
So you keep taking that vacation.
So, Jennifer, do you feel that you're a second-class citizen at your Fortune 500 company because you've been taking your generous vacation?
Do you think I wouldn't be? Is that your question?
Well, I'm wondering if you take your vacation and you're saying that, you know, that the bosses gossip about those who take their vacation, do you feel as though you've been sort of sidetracked career-wise, that you're a second-class citizen in your office because you dare take the vacation offered?
Well, I work from home. I do think that because I've heard it said about other people that you are second class, you're one of those people that uses all your time.
Yeah.
And for me, the work still has to get done.
Right.
So whether I have to work 12-hour days for the month before my vacation to get it all done, it still has to be done.
Okay,
so either getting the work out of me, I'm salaried, I'm not getting overtime, so what's the difference?
Right. There's a point made in the article in Boston Globe by Katie Johnston that we don't keep track of the workers' time if you're salaried, if you stay longer at work, right? Most people who are in an executive or middle manager position work more than the 9 to 5, right? And we don't keep track. Oh, gee, Marjorie, you spent an extra 6 hours this week at work. So why are we keeping track of vacation time? You know, it's like you get we keep track. We don't keep track of how much you give us, but we are going to keep track of how much we give you.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. Front page of the Globe today, piece by Katie Johnston, talking about how there are more and more young tech firms, mostly in the Boston area, up to 10% now, that offer their employees unlimited vacation time, and most of them don't take it. The people that were quoted were on the young side. They were in their 30s. They were mostly men. Didn't say whether these people had kids or not. I mean, this is a dilemma for working mothers. Somebody's got to raise the children, you know, and if...
What about working fathers? You have to start saying working mothers and working fathers.
Working mothers and working fathers, but I think it's I think it's even harder for the working father to be taking time off to be home with the kid. It's one thing for mom to say, I want a maternity leave.
But that's why he has to do it.
That's why dads
have to step up. We need heroes.
Yeah.
We need men to take paternity time.
Now, one of the points in the piece is the sort of paradox here. They're saying that if you're smart enough and ambitious enough and skilled enough to get hired in one of these little startup high-tech firms, you are the kind of person that's not going to take that much vacation anyway because you're a burning cauldron of ambition. And that's a great point. I think the only place you can take vacation anymore without worrying is a government job.
I was just going to say, all the
government employees can call in and complain about it. But, you know,
no, it's true.
We're all jealous of the teachers who are just back to school pretty soon. But they do, after all, have 14 weeks vacation
a
year. Not that I'm counting.
You know what? You know my online dating profile says what I'm looking most for?
Pension.
Someone with a pension. I don't care about anything else. Gender, age.
That's
political viewpoint.
Pension.
I don't care. Do you have a pension and are you about to retire?
When you start hitting 40, 45, 50, 55, you start thinking in terms of pensions and thinking, boy, the people that went to work for the city, the state, the federal government, they were pretty smart.
Yeah, my mother lied to me.
Yeah. Let's go to Jim in Chelmsford. What do you think about people offered unlimited vacation time and not taking it?
Well, I happen to work for a large tech firm outside of Boston, and I happen to be on my first day of vacation. I walked out of the office at 4:30 and said, remember, I'm on vacation. I got a call from my boss at 5 minutes to 5.
Oh, great.
He called me at 20 minutes after 8 this morning. There is no such thing as vacation anymore when you're electronically connected at all of the time.
Jim, are you important? I mean, I don't mean that in the joking way, but I mean...
management. I mean, he thinks I'm important. Apparently, the company can't run without me.
You should have... Did you ask for like $100? Because that's what I would do. I'd just say, great, thanks. I'll take $100. I'll answer your question.
Or does he even apologize? Does he say, Jim, I know you're on vacation. Sorry to call you. Or is it just, Jim, I need this?
Oh, everybody needs something all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? You know when you never get bothered when there's a wake or a funeral? Do you notice that? You can actually say, I'm going to Aunt Mildred's funeral, and no one will call you. So I think you just need to say you're going to funeral.
How many times can you kill off Aunt Mildred, though? That's always the question.
You can't ask me a lot.
How many grandparents' funerals can you squeeze in? Or, you know, and then it has to be, in some offices,
it has to be a death certificate.
Immediate family member. You can't go to Cousin Alice's
funeral. See, that
funeral.
Was one of the beautiful things about being gay and not having official rights, because you could just challenge
That's
them.
Right.
Like, my mother-in-law died. Well, who's that? Why are you challenging the validity of my family? You know, haven't you had 13 grandmothers die? Why are you challenging the validity of my family?
Yeah, who was the kid that got pulled over by the cops and said she was on the way to her father's funeral, and the police officer realized that the father had died 8 years ago or something like that?
She was just getting around to it.
She was trying to get out of her speeding ticket, I believe. Thank you for the call, Jim. I hope he doesn't call you up every day for the rest of your vacation. That's really terrible. Let's take a few more calls here. Fabrizio from Andover. Hi, Fabrizio.
Hi there.
What do you think about not taking your vacation time?
Well, I think the problem with a lot of the tech companies especially is that they put these new policies in place, the unlimited vacation and flex time, but they don't encourage it. I think that the newer companies, that the younger companies might be doing a better job of it, because I think they realize how devoted their employees are to their role, and they understand that there's so much time that's put in outside of regular office hours that they're kind of giving back to encourage these people to stay. Because, you know, what happened, I think, early on with some of the tech companies like Google is that they'd hire these, you know, I think you said burning cauldron of
burning cauldrons of ambition. That's correct.
Yeah. And those cauldrons burn for about 2 years, and then they go for something more stable with a little more of a relaxing atmosphere. Mm-hmm. What happens is these young people get burned out, essentially, and you know, if the culture doesn't change in the workplace to encourage them to take the time off, then they'll just be churning out employees, and they won't be able
Fabrizio,
to
Fabrizio, thank you for the call. That was a great call, and I'm so glad that you mentioned Google, because that place out there, is it Menlo Park? It's somewhere outside near Palo Alto, San Francisco, where they have that. What I think is a Mooney commune out there. I mean, they have this whole campus where they have all this stuff right there, so you have no excuse to leave. You know, they have the food, and they have
dry cleaning,
daycare centers. Yep. You know, they probably have the dentist or the doctor or something like that.
But what's so different from the old factory town, Marjorie, when you get right down
to it? Well, at least you could go three blocks down the street and go to your doctor's office. The Google thing is really kind of creepy, I think. But it's like when they had these law firms downtown. I remember one of these big white shoe, whatever you call them, the law firms downtown called me to do a story years ago about how great it was that they were putting in a daycare center. But what it really was is they were putting in a daycare center on Saturdays.
It's like the firm.
So that these young associates, partners-to-be, these women who are already working 60 hours a week could come in on Saturdays and work as well. So I don't like this whole sort of thing.
Well,
I think you don't want to go to the hairdressers in your office. You want to be able to leave.
Lots of people still say, you know, the lifestyle is more important to me. Lifestyle issues. Quality of life is more important to me than money. And we also know at some point when the rubber hits the road, people take the money.
Yeah.
But it is harder to leave an environment where your needs are at least being addressed. And I think that's the important part.
Let's take one more call. John from Framingham, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. What do you think about vacation time and people not taking it?
Well, I think – hello, first of all.
Hello. How are you, John?
I'm very well. In my company, we get 30 days off, and we have this time and attendance computer program. And when you want to take a day off or a week off or 2 weeks off, you put it in. And what happens is, and out of those 30 days, everybody has to take a few days. It's like Christmas and Thanksgiving, and those are part of that 30 days. However, because my company will pay you if you don't take your vacation time, I have so many colleagues that will, out of that, will maybe take 1 week vacation. And then when they get their money for their unpaid, it's kind of like they're getting paid double time for that week. So they'd rather get paid than take a vacation.
See, I don't have a problem with that, though. I you know, and I...
And, well,
What's your?
I don't either.
Yeah, you know, because sometimes I really don't want to take a vacation, and I'd really, you know, especially if you're just starting out with a family, or you have a mortgage, or you just started your job, you might just want the extra week of pay so you can save up for a better vacation.
Right. Well, in my company, they pay whatever that person's making, so it's a great deal for some people.
Yeah.
My wife happens to work for a school administration department, and if she doesn't take her days, they give them $10 a day. So I say to my wife, crazy, not taking these days. I mean, $10 a day doesn't buy you an iced coffee anymore.
Wait a minute. John, she's not in the right union because there are a lot of unions where if you don't take your time off when you retire, you retire with 4,768 sick days. And I say to myself, God, how do you accumulate 4,000? I'm exaggerating.
I know.
But it's often dozens and dozens of sick days. And these government employees, they're really dedicated. You know, they haven't taken a vacation in 12 years. How can this be? But the guy from Massport, remember when he left Massport, he was getting a big salary. He had $1,760,000 dollars worth of vacation days stored up. It drove me absolutely crazy. But enough of that. We are going to move on.
When we come back, it's time for our recurring segment when we bring an expert in to field your calls. Today, that expert would be pilot Patrick Smith. We'll talk all things air travel next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
I'm Liz Alessi, I live in Cambridge, and I report here. I've just always been a really curious person. A lot of the more interesting stories that I've found have been things that I just stumble upon because they're issues that I hear people talking about and asking questions about, and I have those questions too.
I really think that if patients know better why they're taking their medications, they're more apt to take
them. My job is to do the digging and find out more about that. Liz Alessi, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Boston Children's Hospital. With suburban locations, affiliate hospitals, and over 400 pediatricians throughout Massachusetts, their community of care is always close at hand. Boston Children's Hospital, until every child is well. And Bentley University, offering a new 11-month Bentley MBA with immersive field-based collaborations with hands-on experience at their 3 MBA programs and all 7 of their Masters of Science degrees. Bentley, the business university.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Sue O'Connell is filling in for the vacationing Jim Brady. Okay, we are joined by Patrick Smith. This is our Ask the segment. And in this segment, you can ask the pilot at 877-301-8970. That would be, of course, Patrick, author of Cockpit Confidential, 877-301-8970. Any of your questions? I have a few questions and complaints, so before we get anywhere on this. Now, I am someone, Patrick, that would like to take the train everywhere. I would take the train all around the world if I could, because I hate flying. And one of the reasons I hate flying is every time I go, I feel like I'm a sheep. Not exactly being led to the slaughter, but sort of. You know, I'm being led in this little line. I have to take off my shoes. They're going to take naked pictures of me. I'm going to be like that.
Just
I'm
like
a suspect
college, Marjorie.
Suicide bomber in my little, you know, my little middle-aged mom outfit. And you have no control. I really, really hate it. And you're going to disabuse me of these notions because you tell me it's better, cheaper fares, more carriers, often nonstop options, better perks. Okay, one last thing. I just was lucky enough to go fly to meet my kid who was over in Italy for one of those semesters abroad. I went Alitalia over and Air France back. The food was great. I got unlimited wine. I could have had 17 glasses of wine in Alitalia and Air France. It was a wonderful experience.
She only had 16. She didn't have
17. And, you know, you fly United, you fly American, you get the $5 thing of peanuts. So I don't see this as this great experience. I prefer the train. Tell me why I'm wrong. Patrick Smith, author of Cockpit Confidential.
Well, first of all, Marjorie, everybody hates flying.
They
I
do?
Like flying. I love flying. I love
well,
flying.
Well, most people hate it.
I hate it.
And
I hate it.
That's a lot of why I wrote my book, which is to capitalize on people's contempt
good
for
idea.
Air travel.
Good market research.
Total
good job.
Contempt.
It is total contempt.
Total.
People hate flying. They don't believe anything airlines say. Everything is a scam.
Scam.
We're out to steal your money and
they
get
are.
You killed and everything else.
That's right.
But, you know, flying has changed a lot since 9/11, thereabouts, for better and for worse. A couple of points on the better side. First of all, flying is remarkably affordable, despite what a lot of people seem to believe. Fares are about half of what they were 30 years ago. And even though over the past couple of years fares have come up slightly, mm-hmm. we're still about 15% less than we were in the year 2000.
Really?
And this despite huge increases in the cost of fuel.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't all that long ago when only a small segment of the population mm-hmm. could afford to fly at all. And now, really, everybody can fly. It's
that's
a different world.
My mother, mother went her whole life without ever getting in a plane because it was unaffordable. When
I was a kid, it wasn't at all unusual to meet people who'd never mm-hmm. been in an airplane.
Right.
But
yeah.
try to find somebody today who's never flown. And by the way, that 30% or that 50% cheaper airfares statistic includes those ancillary fees, the baggage fees that airlines love and that people hate. That's all factored in.
Yep.
Flying is half of what it cost 30 years ago, and that's lost on a lot of people, especially younger people.
And so why can I get the free wine and delicious meals in Alitalia and Air France and I have to pay $5 for peanuts on United?
Well, that's a whole other topic, which is the passenger service standards of U.S. carriers compared to those in to those carriers in other countries.
Yeah, doesn't the government underwrite some of the foreign carriers too? Is this
some
sort of a
them.
Socialist thing? You're socialist. That's so, what
well,
it is.
Well, some of them, not all, but it's well established, and it's been this way for decades, that U.S. carriers really don't compare service-wise mm-hmm. to carriers from other parts in the world. Having said that, we've gotten better over the past 5-10 years. On an American carrier now, you've got things like live TV and onboard Wi-Fi. I mean, these are things that didn't exist 15 mm-hmm. years ago. It's not a pleasant experience for everybody, but it's affordable, and you have certain perks that have made the experience better.
There's so much about flying I love. I can't even get in. You know, I love that I don't have to do anything. I like to pretend that when I'm sitting there, it's like my big living room, and people are waiting on me. You know, I'm just sitting there with my book and my blanket. You know, it took me an extra 35 minutes to get here to the station today because of traffic. And, I'm not really complaining about it that much.
You should have had Patrick pick you up.
But if I were in the air, people would be freaking out about it. You know, I mean, it's air travel. And it's so safe. It's so inexpensive. I love it.
Okay, but now let's look at the downside.
Oh, now you're going to bring me down.
It would only be fair. Delays.
Yeah. Delays.
You've got more planes in the air than ever before. Mm-hmm. And although more people are flying aboard more planes, the average size of an aircraft has gotten smaller. So there are more planes to carry these more people.
Right.
And most of these additional aircraft in recent years are regional jets, smaller planes that they don't make an efficient use of airspace. You've got half of all the takeoffs and landings in the country carrying 15 or 20% of the passengers.
And the regional jets are the ones that we've read scary things about the lack of training for the
pilots. No, I wouldn't say that.
You wouldn't?
But they are small, and a lot of people don't like them. And, mm-hmm. and most of the connection and express regional jet operators are subcontractors operating on behalf of their major carrier affiliates. These aren't owned, usually, by the major carriers. They're not staffed by major carrier employees. These are contractors, although they wear the colors
uniforms,
of the major carrier.
Yep.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you have any questions for Patrick, this is our Ask the Pilot segment. It's Ask the, and he is our the today. He is Patrick Smith, the pilot and author of Cockpit Confidential. So I interrupted you when you were telling me about the bad things. Delays.
She wants to get back to that.
Airport security.
Oh, airport security.
These naked screener things that don't really keep you safe because you could be putting things in body cavities or folds of flesh, but they have you taking these pictures anyway. And they said that no one would get the pictures. That was a big lie.
TSA and airport security is something we could talk about all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an essay in Chapter 5 in the book that gets into everything that's wrong with the mm-hmm. process. Where to start on that?
Yeah,
it's just wrong.
Yeah,
I mean, TSA has to, at some point, get away from this philosophy, this strategy that every single person who flies is a potential terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a country where you've got over 2 million people flying every day, that's just not a sustainable approach. And we've kept at it now for 10 years or more, and it's just not working.
I went through a period where I was actually before 9/11, where every single time I flew, I was pulled out of line. This is before the full-on security. I don't actually don't know why. I probably because I had that big pig triangle tattooed on my head. But I, you know, for some reason, there was something about me, and I would be, you know, I'd say to people when I'm traveling, "Here we go," and they take my. And now when I travel with when my child was 8 years old, we traveled back and forth to the Vineyard and to Nantucket. And we would all the she'd get pulled out like, you know, patting down a 9 year old. It drives
really?
Me crazy. They and think, I'm fine. I mean, I'm not one of those. How dare you? It just go with the flow and get it done. But at the same time, you're right. It's crazy.
Before we take some calls, 877-301-8970, we will in just a second. I just want to ask you. Okay, on the security, Patrick Smith, what could we be doing better?
Well, we need to move to what's called a risk-based approach, and that gets into the subject of profiling. And,
right.
And people
yeah.
hear that, oh, my God. And we're not talking about the kind of profiling where all the people of, you know, one skin color or from one country get in this line and everybody else gets in the other line. It involves taking in a whole wide range of data points and putting together. There's a scientific way to do it.
The Israelis do that, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And I hear all the time, well, why can't we do what the Israelis do? Well, we can do part of what they do. But remember, Israel has one international airport,
yeah.
basically. We have dozens of very busy international airports. And you can't just take what they have and extrapolate it up to a country as large as ours. But there are points and aspects of their approach that we probably should adopt.
877-301-8970. Kyra from Concord, you are on our Ask the segment. Ask what you choose of Patrick Smith, author of Cockpit Confidential. Kyra.
Wonderful. Thank you. And by the way, Marjorie, and it's Wendy, right?
No, actually, it's Sue O'Connell
today.
From Bay Windows.
Oh, Sue, no, I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Okay.
I look just like Wendy.
She does.
I apologize. Yes, I thank you for taking my phone call. I've been a long-time listener and second-time caller. And
thank you.
No big deal. I get it at all different variations of cheer. But I'd just like you to know that, I'd like to ask you, rather, Patrick and Susan and Marjorie, about air quality on the planes and how we can make it better.
Great question.
Thank you very much, Kara. That is a great question. So what's the deal on the air quality?
There's a Q&A in chapter...
You get infected by all sorts of diseases on the airplanes, too.
There's a Q&A in chapter 5 about this. The air quality on airplanes is a lot cleaner than people think.
Really?
A portion of the air is recirculated, but there's normally a total changeover of air every several minutes, depending on the aircraft type. People do get sick on planes, but it's not because of what they breathe. It's usually because of what they touch. That is dirty
okay.
tray tables, dirty armrests, lavatory handles and whatnot.
And then touching their face.
So wait a minute. So you should bring like disinfectant wipes with you on the airplane?
Just wash
those
your hands.
Are those allowed?
Just wash your hands.
You know, I'm not one of those germaphobes the
yeah.
way people are, and I don't advocate being that way.
Purell.
But I think carrying a little hand sanitizer
yeah.
would probably be a much more effective measure than those silly masks I sometimes see passengers wearing.
Do you see a lot of passengers with masks?
Yeah.
I always thought they had a dread disease. That's
well, sometimes they wear them because they're sick and they don't want to get
right.
others
yeah.
sick.
Right.
So, you know, one of the articles that we were looking at in preparation for the show is also this idea that there's not a lot of airline loyalty. I've never been a person who has had a loyalty to one particular brand of airline. I'm a price shopper. When I had frequent flyer miles, they were too complicated for me to use, so I didn't pay any attention to them. Is that a trend that we're seeing now? Is folks just going with the price shopping, or are there still people who will only fly one airline?
There are a lot of people who are
Loyalists
to this or that carrier because
yeah.
of the frequent flyer
yeah.
Programs and the way they're structured. But those can really vary airline to airline, alliance to alliance.
877-301-8970 is our number. So here's the good things. We have a little sheet here that tells us the good things. And correct me if I'm missing anything wrong. Patrick Smith, author of Cockpit Confidential. Better is cheaper fares. Better is more carriers offering more nonstop options. Excuse me. Better onboard perks like Wi-Fi and live TV. But unless you fly a foreign airline, you're not going to get any food. It's going to be terrible. You have to pay $17 for a Coke or something.
Mm-hmm.
Worse is airport security delays. And this is a great point. U.S. airports falling into disrepair. It's like the whole United States is falling into disrepair. I'm always stunned when I go, you know, out of my little cocoon here in Boston. I could visit towns around Massachusetts, and Massachusetts is not a poor state, or go to other countries and see the airports. They're gorgeous, and ours are like rusting. So what's the deal there?
Our airports are infrastructurally challenged. Let's just put it that way. It's sad. Have you ever been to Incheon Airport in Korea?
Oh, no. My God, no. I've barely been to New York
City. You can make a vacation just of this airport.
Really?
Bangkok, Hong Kong, Munich, Singapore. It goes on, all outside the United States.
Government money?
A lot of it, but these countries' governments seem to realize how important commercial air travel is to their economies, and they invest in airports. They invest in their carriers. They don't tax the heck out of them the way we do.
Huh. Well, do we have any really ratty airports in the United States of America that people should avoid?
You've been to LaGuardia lately?
No. Yeah. Horrible?
LaGuardia's horrible.
It's pretty bad.
It's been horrible for a long time.
In a perpetual state of massive construction.
Yeah, and it's just, you just feel like you're in a hangar.
But meanwhile, can I throw in a plug for our own little Logan. Hometown airport, Logan, which I think is one of the most underappreciated airports in the country.
Why?
It's well organized. Uh-huh. It's very clean. It's small enough that it's easy to move from terminal to terminal without too much fuss. There's a halfway decent public transport link to the city, which is something you almost never find in the United States.
Mm-hmm. That's a good
terminals
point.
Terminals A and E are two of the most attractive major
He's
terminals
very nice.
In the
nice.
Country.
The international.
You know, speaking
the
of nice terminals, Snowden, you know, the
Edward Snowden.
Edward lived at a terminal in Russia.
Sure, Mtyevo,
have you been there?
It's been a long time, but I have been to that airport.
Would you live there?
Not from what I remember of it, but I don't think he had much of a choice.
They did have Wi-Fi. We have a very important caller that we should get
to. Oh, my goodness. One of our colleagues.
Yes.
Callie, if I may say, Crossley, who also works here at WGBH. She has a great show every Sunday night at 6:30, Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Callie Crossley, your question for Patrick Smith, author of Cockpit Confidential, and also I should give Patrick's website. This is a very, very brilliant website.
Thank
AskThePilot.com. Right to the point. Right to the point. Callie, what do you want to ask Patrick?
Well, actually, there's a couple of things I just wanted to comment on. One, maybe Logan is organized well everywhere else except Terminal C, wherever JetBlue is. That is a nightmare.
Yeah. Terminal C is the weak spot of Logan. You're correct. But JetBlue is putting millions into renovating that building, so it's being upgraded.
You better hurry up. Yeah. But I'm telling people now, if you're on your way to JetBlue, and I love JetBlue.
Yeah, me too.
That is the one place that you will
die
standing in line. It is not moving. They have like three people there. I don't know what. And it used to be great. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what they did when they moved over there, but it's horrific.
Yes.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, when I was a producer at ABC News 2020 working with Dr. Timothy Johnson, we did a huge piece testing the air with scientists on the plane, looking at recirculated air, what the bacteria was on the seats. It's gross. And
it
I fly a lot. So unless something is dramatically changed.
Callie, I'm going to disagree. And I think maybe the thing here is, I don't know how long ago that study would have been.
It may have dramatically changed since then. It may have, but it was.
Because there's a whole new generation of aircraft out there.
Yeah.
And maybe that was true with the prior generation. But cabin air quality today is surprisingly clean.
Yeah.
All I can tell you is it was really
generally
then. So
generally.
you just want to know that. And with regard to frequent flyer programs, it's not about the loyalty so much as it is about getting on that daggone plane first. So people will fly the same plane just so they can have that as a perk because the airlines have taken away everything else. So to get on the plane first so you can put your bag in and have some space is really important. And people will just about kill you to get on the plane
first. Well, see, Kelly, I just lie. I just lie. And I'm traveling with I need some special accommodations. I just grab a kid or I limp or I look confused.
Kelly,
you know, which isn't hard for me to do to look confused.
Knowing you as I do, maybe this bothers you the way it bothers me. I get why they put the first class passengers on first because they're paying more money and they get to sit down first. But there's something like really, like you are really, you know, the untouchables when you have to walk by all these people in first class and they're having their champagne and they're spreading out and they're wide in their seats. And you think, look at these people with six kids. How can they afford these first class seats? And then you're relegated to your little smashed like a sardine seat in the back of the airplane. Don't you find that really enraging, Callie Crossley? I hope you do.
Well, you know, I just take it as that's what it is, and I wish I had their money, because then you could look at me while you walk past.
Well, on wide-bodied, wide-bodied aircraft, you usually board through the second door.
Right, so they're in the front.
Premium cabin class passengers go one way, and economy go the other way.
I would like that.
You know what I do, Marjorie?
Feel better, Marjorie. Yeah. Good first class is really hard to get now.
Yeah,
it
so
is?
It's just sort of, you know, maybe they're giving you a nicer napkin in most of the time. No, domestic flights is not that good.
Yeah, it's just it's sometimes not even worth the money.
Patrick, tell us why first class is not so good anymore.
Oh, I think it's better than it's ever been.
Okay, Kelly, why do you think it's
bad? At least on intercontinental flights, on long-haul flights. First-class cabins nowadays are above and beyond anything, going all the way back to the days of the flying boats.
If you're going to fly Boston to Denver, though, you might as well just save the
money. U.S. domestic first-class really is just economy with a little bigger seat.
You know what I do, Marjorie?
I said a nicer napkin. That's it.
There you go. I say hi to people when I'm walking through. I go, hi, hello, hi.
Yeah, I really hate that. Callie, do you have any more complaints for
no, that's
for,
it. I'll comments. Say this to Patrick, who I dated a pilot for a hot minute a long time ago. Uh-oh. And I told him how much I hate it when you guys keep going on and on about the Rockies and the rivers and everything. I'm trying to sleep or read my book. And he said to me, hey, you want us to talk, because if we're not talking, we're on automatic pilot. Is that true?
Oh, here we go. Automatic pilot. big and angry segment in chapter 4 of my book about this. I think autopilot, cockpit automation and the way pilots interact with that automation is one of the most wildly exaggerated and completely misunderstood things in all of commercial aviation. It really is.
You're not asleep in there. I mean,
No.
Okay, all right.
And this idea that airplanes fly themselves, I mean, that is simply preposterous. I mean, autopilot, compare it, if you will, to cruise control in your car.
Yes.
You know, it relieves you of certain tasks, but cruise control can't drive your car from one city to the other just the way the autopilot can't fly an airplane from one city to the other.
Well, you know, Patrick, I think he had other strategies in mind, if you know what I'm saying. But I just wanted to ask you since you were there.
Callie Crossley, thank you very much for that great call and your complaints. I'd love to hear complaints from my fellow workers. You know, but Callie made me think of something that you have talked about in your book as well, Cockpit Confidential. Cell phones. You know, I always get nervous. I want everybody to turn off their cell phones, by the way. I don't want to listen to anybody's conversation when I'm on an airplane. But I do always get nervous when you see people with their iPods and their cell phone and their iPads and everything. Well, not iPods, but iPads. Not turning them off in time. And I'm always thinking, oh, my God, the plane's going to crash because too many people have their cell phones on. That's a paranoia on my part, I assume.
I so want to travel with you, Marjorie.
There's a lot about this that just isn't known. I mean, it's not likely that a cell phone is going to interfere with cockpit equipment, but it is possible. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence out there of it happening. There were two accidents, one in Switzerland, one in New Zealand, that investigators believe may have been attributable to a ringing phone, but they're not sure. It's one of those things. It's impossible to prove.
The ring interfered, not the electronic whatever it is.
But you know, so, ultimately, though, I think this comes down to being a social issue, not a technological one. That is, do you want to be sitting on an airplane with 200 people all talking on their phones at the same time?
You know what drives me crazy is the captain of industry who will not put his cell phone away when the flight attendants and pilot
after
are telling
him to.
After
he's been asked three times. That's the part.
I don't know whether or not it really interferes or not, and I don't care. But when everybody else is putting their cell phone away and powering down, I just want to get up and flick them in the head with my finger because it drives me crazy.
Remember Alec Baldwin?
That would drive me crazy. I would throw him right off the plane.
Or something like that.
Interesting is that the airplane really is, in a lot of ways, is the quietest part of the whole air travel experience. U.S. airports especially are so damn loud. Mm. You've got PA announcements, sometimes three or four of them playing at the same time. You've got those damn
Logan has
news
music.
Monitors.
They've got
You've
the
got
great
music at Logan Radio,
I love that.
I wish they would just turn it off.
Oh, my friends are running that.
And it's not until you get onto the airplane that you can finally chill out and get some peace and quiet. And I hope we keep it that way.
The piece I'm really excited about, and I've been looking into this for a couple of years, is this rent the private plane to go with your friends to go on a short trip. You know, that it's an actual affordable option if you're traveling in a group and you're traveling to certain places. And there are some pilots who are able to sort of maximize their inventory when they're flying back and forth. Is this something that you think is exciting, that if 12 people want to go to Hilton Head and go golfing, they can rent one of these private planes?
It's extremely expensive.
Well, you know, they
how
say
expensive?
That it's not really, though.
Depends on the airplane. But.
Yeah, and it looks at how much, you know, per person you're really spending. If you've got, and sometimes you get to bypass security completely,
right? I was about to say,
right?
It would be worth any price to bypass TSA. But
you know that if you fly, a $750 a head if you're going from New York to Hilton Head, you know,
well, that's
round
not
trip.
Bad. That's not bad. How many people you have to have? Like 25 people in the airplane?
No, like 12. It's, you know.
Our number is 877-301-8970. We are here with Patrick Smith, author of Cockpit Confidential, and his website is askthepilot.com. But you can ask the pilot in person right now at 877-301-8970 or email us at bpr@wgbh.org. By the way, Patrick, when you were flying full-time, I assume you're not flying full-time because you're writing books now.
Oh, I'm flying full-time.
You're flying full-time. Mm-hmm. So what do you fly?
I just came back from Africa 2 days ago.
What do you fly?
767.
And tell me what a 767 is.
It's a medium-sized twin-engine long-range aircraft.
Uh-huh.
I also fly a 757. The 57 and 67 are a rare example of we can be qualified on two aircraft at the same time,
okay,
because they're so similar. But that's very unusual.
So how'd you get to be a big aircraft pilot?
Through the magic of seniority.
Seniority. I mean, were you in the military or anything?
Yeah, how did you become a pilot?
My background is strictly civilian. Yeah. I grew up in Revere, actually.
Oh, you both did. Yeah.
Don't hold it against me.
I know.
Watching the airplanes come in over Revere Beach when I was young, and did my primary training at Beverly, and then I was a flight instructor, and then I worked for three different regional carriers, and then flew cargo planes at DHL before my present position.
You know, one of the challenges now with the fuel cost being so high is that it's really hard to find folks who fly for pleasure or fly as a hobby. It's really, I mean, it was probably always a rich man's game, but, mm-hmm, you know, there was a period there where a lot of folks were taking flying lessons, and it just seems to be prohibitive now. And if you're not going into the military, I guess it might be harder to find a path to be a pilot.
Well, a lot of pilots are bailing out, mm-hmm, of the they're not getting into the profession because it's such a long process, and there's simply no guarantee of getting a good job at the end. And part of that is the proliferation of these regional airlines. Mm-hmm. It used to be that you worked at a regional carrier as a stepping stone to a major, but
right,
these carriers are now such a huge segment of the industry, and the major carriers have really stopped hiring over the past 10 years or so. And so these guys are figuring out, guys and girls, that a position at a regional carrier likely means an entire career at a regional carrier.
And it's not good money.
And that's not a good return on investment,
yeah,
because it you know, you have to outlay $100,000 or more just to earn your primary licenses and ratings and then build up the necessary hourly experience, mm-hmm, on top of that before you can even think about applying for a regional airline job. And the starting pay at these carriers is somewhere around $20,000 a year.
Wow. Oh, that's horrible. Paula from Ipswich, you're on with askthepilot.com. Patrick Smith, what do you want to ask Patrick, Paula?
Hi, Patrick. First of all, I just want to say, Marjorie, I love your show. I have to say, I've kind of switched from WBUR to WGBH.
Woo! Call anytime, Paula. Call anytime.
Listen to you guys.
Thank you.
It's such a fascinating show. And, Peter, I just have to tell you that, respectfully, I really disagree with you. I mean, I've been traveling since I was a college student. So when you said things have changed, you know, 30 years ago, I mean, I remember 30 years ago, flights were inexpensive and they were comfortable and people were polite. And I just got back from a cross-country trip, and maybe you can help me, but I was flying a Boeing, I think it was a 737-800, which is really a plane for regional travel that they, United flew across country from Boston to San Francisco. It was very uncomfortable. And the other thing I wanted to say was this Economy Plus, that you can get buy a seat for money. Even that on United varies. So there are some of those seats that don't recline, and there are some of those seats that don't have good access. So you're paying extra money for a seat that's really inferior. And I just have to say that
you're not happy. You're not happy.
Well, look, personal experiences vary. Comfort on aircraft, can vary plane to plane, airline to airline.
Peter, your generalizations that airfare.
It's not a generalization. It's statistically true. Fares are half of what they were 30 years ago. That's either true or it's not true.
He's got it all documented in Cockpit Confidential, Paula.
And while airplane interiors are a little tighter than they used to be, the average amount of personal space on commercial planes really hasn't changed in the past 30
years.
We hear over and over again how airlines are cramming more and more people in. That's just not true.
Bigger people, right?
Well, I meant, you know,
do you remember People Express in the yes. early 1980s? I mean, talk yes. about a sardine can.
That was small.
Or Laker.
Paul, do you have any more complaints or is that it?
Just one more thing.
Okay. I knew you did. Go ahead.
I know. I just want to say now, and this is very respectful to you because I do respect you guys up there in the skies, but when you fly today, are you in the middle seat in economy? Do you experience that when you wrote your book? Did you take flights in that, or were you up in first class?
I fly as a passenger all the time. I commute to and from my base in New York, so I am more than well acquainted with a middle seat in economy class.
Paula, thank you for the call and thank you for the kind words. And I hope your flying future is better than your flying past.
You know, I think
Paula's with me. She'd be in the train, the high speed train.
Yeah, but the statistics
on the ground, big bathrooms. Do you ever notice the bathrooms on the plane? You could have 17 people. You could have a cocktail party in the bathrooms on trains on Amtrak. Have you noticed that? Of course, it's very expensive to take Amtrak.
Well, you got to put people in the plane. I mean, the train is very expensive. I find the train to be just totally.
Love it.
Uncomfortable. I find it totally uncomfortable.
You're kidding.
I find the motion of the train. I find trying to walk to get my own food. I want someone to wait on me.
Audrey,
I'm giving
my book to her instead of to you.
To defend Patrick, I would say that you know the statistics are based on the whole number of all the flights. I would imagine, and if you're flying a particular route or a particular airline, it's not a guarantee that those prices are higher.
Fares vary market to market. You know, in some markets, historically, have high fares.
You know, so if it can be your travel, your particular type of travel, your route may be more expensive.
I will grant that caller the point of passengers being less civil than in years past.
It's doggy dog.
That is certainly true. A couple of things there. That's part of people's contempt for flying coming out, manifesting itself that way. And just the hassles and stresses of flying on the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, security and the long lines.
But
I flew
last year, I think, and there was a situation. I forget what the issue was, but one of the flights couldn't take off, or it was late, or there was a weather problem, and there were people who just could be heard on their cell phone canceling wedding anniversary dinners.
Yeah,
people gave up their seats to them.
That's lovely.
It really, it was really just a nice moment.
Okay.
I
have one last crabby question before we move on. You know, we've all had this experience. You know, you're in the back of the plane, row 25, and I have three children. I love children, but you know the terror ordeal.
When you see
a couple coming down with three kids under the age of 40, you think, oh my God, and they're going to be crying all the way from here to my destination. Anybody ever thought about having a kids section on the plane so all the parents can be together with their kids crying and they all, you know, empathize with each other and the adults, the above 18 section can, you know, have their cocktails and
relax.
You're
not the first person to suggest that, and I think, I forget if there's a segment in the book about that or not, but I've written about that before recommending the idea myself. You know, a screaming section, the way we used to have a smoking section.
Exactly.
On airplanes.
Like they have in some churches behind the glass at the back of the church.
Well, I think the parents would feel less awful, too, because, I mean, I've been on planes with my kids, and my kids are making noises, and I felt terrible and embarrassed and mortified, but there's nothing you can do because it hurts their little ears sometimes.
I just don't know how effective that would be, though, because you'd need to be a good distance away from that section, and I recommend everybody should carry a pair of foam earplugs.
That's a great idea, actually.
If not, an iPod.
And one of those neck things, you know, because you don't want to be next to the person that suddenly, and you don't know them, and they're already kind of taking your space in the seat because they're a big person, and then they put their head on your shoulder.
Yeah.
Has that ever happened to you? That could be very upsetting, Patrick. You know what I
mean? That's how I met my second wife.
There you go.
I'm not kidding. Bada-bing.
There you go. Well, Patrick, this has been wonderful. This has been very informative. I'm sorry if I seemed hostile about it.
No, not at all.
But I do
Everybody hates flying, so I don't take offense to that.
I love flying.
Well, I like it
My
when
book
I'm up
is
there.
Written for people who hate flying.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay.
We've been speaking with Patrick Smith. He's an airline pilot, and you can read his blog at askthepilot.com. His new book is Cockpit Confidential, Everything You Need to Know About Air Travel. Patrick, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very
thanks
much.
For having me.
When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Globe columnist Alex Beam. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Nikola Tesla has become a celebrated underdog of electricity.
But I've never really figured out why of all things, Edison thought the Tesla's family might have been cannibals.
I'm Kara Miller. On Innovation Hub this week, we talk with Tesla's biographer about the electrifying genius and failings of Nikola Tesla. Thursday night at 9, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Davis Mom and DeAugustine, PC, attorneys at law, knowing the lay of the land, not just the law, on the web at davismalm.com, DAVISMALM.com. And the Boston Speaker Series, presented by Lesley University, offering 7 evenings at Symphony Hall with a lineup of speakers that includes a prime minister, a Pulitzer Prize winner, a humorist, and even a former spy. BostonSpeakerSeries.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Sue O'Connell is filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. Sue O'Connell, by the way, is from South End News and Bay Windows, in case you don't know. Usually at this time every week, we hear from Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe. Today, we hear from his curmudgeonly employee or underling, whatever you are.
Underling.
Yeah, whatever
Alex
you are.
Beam, underling.
Alex Beam, who's a columnist at the Globe. Mr. Fussy, some of us have called
him. Un-Brian McGrory.
Un-Brian McGrory,
My
yes.
career trajectory is like his turned upside down.
Exactly. Now, you're a big crab, Alex Beam.
Thank you so much.
We were just
Marjorie.
Talking to Patrick Smith, the pilot, about flying. I bet you detest flying. Do you not? Those crowds in the airport, people rubbing up against you, forcing
I
you to
heard
take off your shoes.
Your many bizarre outbursts. I've known Patrick Smith for decades.
You have?
Yes. And I hate the kind of person who says the kind of thing I'm about to say, but I really wrote about him. I would argue first. I've been a fan of his for decades.
Really?
Aside from all this, now that he's out of the studio, aside from all this kind of like useful how-to stuff, he's a lovely writer.
I can't speak about that. Confidential is the name of his book.
Yeah. Every time his piece about watching the planes land from living in Revere, which is something if you grow up in Revere, you just do. Watch them, you know, all the flight patterns. It's so eloquent. It so captures it's not nostalgic, but it is a snapshot of being young and wishing you were on those planes.
Yeah. Castle Island is also a good spot from which to watch the planes.
Yeah, Winthrop. I can't praise his writing enough. I know that he has to sell the book on the strength of, you know, is my armrest have boogers on it. But
thank you. That was elegantly put.
It's public radio.
Yeah.
But he has made a huge effort to see the world's airports. He's really an expert on the world's airports. He's an expert on plane types. Anyway, but why praise him? Enough about Patrick.
Well, I want to hear about you getting on an airplane and in the crowd of people and having to take off your shoes and your belt and open your computer and having to get them in those little gray containers in time without the people behind you getting worked up and putting your little 3 ounces of liquid, whatever you're carrying, in those little ridiculous see-through containers so that you can take your stuff on the airplane. I can't see you being happy about
that. Look, I'm going to lay some candor on you. I used to be very frightened of flying, as Patrick well knows, and I've flown a lot of sketchy airlines. But since 2001, I figure if no one has slit the pilot's throat, we're probably going to land safely.
Yeah, that's a good point. And plus, if you fly internationally at some other sketchy airlines, you really come to appreciate American Airlines. I mean, I have been on a flight landing in Honduras where, the movie wasn't over, which I thought was my biggest problem. But then they also didn't put they had full bar that they were going through with, you know, and they hadn't put the card away. They didn't tell you were landing and things were falling. And I was just thinking, if that's emblematic of our safety, you know, you fly in Russia and the doors open and luggage falls out.
Oh, yeah, the
12-year-old
is piloting
sitting.
The plane.
Yeah,
oh,
I mean, it's...
Okay.
You,
but Alitalia and Air France... Yes. Give you great food and free wine, and in the United States, you'd pay $5 a piece. But okay, let's move on from
the landing safe. I should say, actually, I try to sit next to pilots, and because I am a little frightened, and I've never asked Patrick this question, but I did once sit next to an American pilot, and I said, you know, what is the most extreme experience you've ever had? And he did say, coming out of Colorado Springs, an airport I'll be avoiding in the future, he lost control of the airplane for 18 seconds due to air coming off of the Rocky Mountains. And Patrick loves to debunk stories like this. I'm glad he's not here because he always leaps in and says, oh, that's an exaggeration. But this came from an actual American Airlines pilot.
I love to sit in the seat. If you fly Cape Air and it's not busy, you can sit up front. you know, if there's an empty seat. And sometimes they have you sit up there just for they have to ask you your weight, which is also, you know.
Yeah.
But it's, I love it. I love it.
But, you know, when you speak of good writing, though, one of my favorite, well, not one of my favorites, but it's up there. I like it, is Tom Wolfe describing in The Right Stuff, the pilots. And he's talking about the voices and how you want to have a pilot with a deep voice and preferably a southern twang who tells you as you're rocking around in the airplane and, you know, things are flying and you're a nervous wreck. Everything's fine.
Don't worry, I'm in charge.
I mean, that, you do. You think, oh, okay. We have. You know, who is the guy that played The Right Stuff? The handsome guy, Sam Shepard.
Sam Shepard.
Oh, that was in The Right Stuff. He played one of the first astronauts to go up.
One of the airlines had you could listen
He broke the sound barrier. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you could listen to air traffic control while you were landing. And one particularly very difficult landing, I listened and I was horrified. And as I was getting off, I said to the I said to the crew and the captain, "Thanks for flying." I said, "Great job landing." I was listening. That was a little terrifying. He said, "You should see how we felt."
Great.
Like, great. Well, yeah, it's United has Channel 11, which I've written a whole column about Channel 11. It's like nerd feed for flying nerds. ATC is generally pretty reassuring. Patrick Smith used to have on his website actually a link to some ATC. He lands at Kennedy a lot. Yeah. Once he made two go rounds and landed only on the third try because the weather was so intense. Oh. And he had a link to him laughing and just, you know, kind of was shrieking sort of with laughter and despair. And ATC, they're kind of making fun of him in the tower.
Yeah.
Because that was pretty – he hates to admit that anything is ever a difficult experience. But two go-arounds in bad weather is indeed a difficult experience.
Yeah, I would not like that. So let's move on for a second. You really can't stand our senior senator Elizabeth Warren. You wrote this really rather nasty piece about her. You called Warren, that's Elizabeth Warren, the big noise because she's talking a lot about regulation of the banks and regulation of Wall Street and stuff like that. I think that's great because I don't think we have regulated Wall Street. You're right. She hasn't gotten anything passed yet. But what is your problem?
What is this? The hot seat? I have to come into GBH and answer for my centrist
views?
Not
only that, there must have been about 27 letters to the editor saying that jerk Alex Beam attacking Elizabeth Warren.
I have never seen a column by Alex Beam picked apart line by line like this one was.
People were after you. So what is your problem with Elizabeth Warren? I love the fact. You know what I love particularly about the fact that she was talking to these different regulators is that she was smarter than most of them and she was able to go toe-to-toe.
Oh, look, I'm smarter than you, Marjorie. If I'm sitting up here on a raised platform looking down at you, controlling the microphone, I mean, look, you know why people do columns? I mean, if only Brian McGrory were here. I mean,
He's not here. He's listening to every word.
I don't work for Brian McGrory, for the record.
Oh, you don't?
I have in the
past. That's
right. I have in the past. But, you know, you do a column because you can, I think. You of all people, yourself with decades of columnizing behind you, sometimes you do a column because you can. Mm-hmm. And I was just tired of this. All my Facebook friends, like Miss O'Connell, you know, and the litany of kind of the one-note rubbish in the Globe. Oh, she stood up to Tim Geithner. Well, you know, you're not standing up to Tim Geithner if you know that the $6 billion has already been spent. You're really just grandstanding. And I think that she had an unparalleled record of grandstanding. I mean,
you mean as a U.S. senator or before that, or both?
Well, I don't know much about her before. I mean, what's interesting about her, obviously, is her election victory. That's interesting and to be praised, because she did so much better than Coakley
Brown.
And against Brown. I just think she's a fraud in the Senate, like a total fraud. But that's a minority view. I mean, I'm not saying that the world's going to come to see her as I do. Okay.
You know, I think she has a media relations problem, and it's not necessarily related to how she talks to the media, but it's how she treats the media. And I think that it was really brought to the forefront when she had that press conference with Governor Patrick right after she was elected. Mm-hmm. And Governor Patrick, I forget what the topic was, but he was answering questions and she kept saying, "I don't know." And she kind of brushed the media off. And I think that when you, in the words of our great president, misunderestimate the media and don't understand where the media can help you, help your cause, help America, hurt America, it's really a bad miscalculation. And her issue of not talking to the press
continuing
in the hallways.
In their jihad over there at Morrissey Boulevard at the Boston Globe, there was a front page story.
Okay,
I'm trying
good.
To get
yeah,
an issue with her today, as a matter of fact, for the Boston Herald.
Good luck.
But I'm going to try. We've had a good relation. I love her husband, actually. He's a delightful guy. But anyway, you had this whole front page article criticizing her for racing away from the press in the Senate halls, that she was sprinting toward those little underground, whatever they are.
That was an interesting piece.
From reporters.
But had an interesting counterpoint in there. I think, by the way, Sue's 100% right here. Hearing Sue talk, I realized, of course, it all goes back to the Indian stuff, right? She feels the media is her enemy because she got, you know, jobbed on the whole Indian thing. Separate conversation. But I couldn't agree with you more. And the thing is that she's frightened of the media, which is ridiculous. And in that piece that you're mentioning, in the very last graph of that piece, of course, Ed Markey's over in the corner. I saw Ed Markey in Harvard Yard like a year ago. I came up to him, you know. I mean, Ed Markey gets it. You know, he's not frightened of you. But if you project fear to the media, the media kind of gets nervous themselves.
I think the Cherokee Nation criticism really did scare her because she couldn't go anywhere without being asked
about
it.
But she didn't deal with it directly.
I couldn't agree more.
I just found out. I was going on and on about how I was more American Indian than she was, and I just found out a month ago I'm not.
You're not?
No, because the woman in our family who was a Native American, we just found out, was our step great great grandmother.
Well, people tell
stories
in their family.
If I were running for office, I would just say that.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with you. I felt that I didn't put that in the column because
it's time.
It would have been a big he thinks it's still she's a Cheyenne or something. But
Cherokee.
Yeah, like whatever. I care. But in my heart of hearts, I think that she never put that to rest. You know. But then the way the whole globotomy works is that at the globotomy, you know, you're not supposed to raise that issue anymore. Well, really, why not? She's really never told the truth about it. But blah blah blah, she's moved on.
No, well, many of us, including myself, wrote columns that she hadn't been I don't think forthcoming about that. But the thing is, you can't keep doing that over and over and again. I mean, she's been elected now. She's United States Senator. Well, okay, enough about Elizabeth Warren and your thing with her, Alex, because clearly you have a thing with her, Alex Beam, curmudgeonly columnist.
But thank you for mentioning the letters, because I always saw myself as rivaling Jeff Jacoby in negative letters.
I know, so.
Well, the famous story about Jeff Jacoby is, of course, a more conservative columnist at the Boston Globe. Jeff Jacoby has told many people, including myself, that no one will eat lunch with him in the cafeteria at the Boston Globe. Is that true, Alex Beam?
You know, I have two things to say to that. Three things. Sadly, it is true. No, B, I used to have an office next door to Jeff, and I really like Jeff. And C, I think that is a terrible, terrible indictment of the Boston Globe. I think Jacoby's been treated poorly socially and professionally. And it has always bothered me that there's just no breadth. There's no breadth of generosity there about intellectual differences.
Mm-hmm. Well, he used to work at the Boston Herald, and he was one of the gang over there at the Boston Herald.
Because he was a crazy liberal at the Boston Phoenix. I mean, at the Boston Herald.
No, he was conservative at the Boston Herald.
No, I mean, compared to everybody else.
By the way, Keith just emailed in at bpr@wgbh.org saying the media's problem with Senator Warren is she won't answer questions. She beats around the bush big time if she answers them at all. That feeds into your theory. I am trying to get an interview with Senator Warren today, so I think that she's lovely and answering questions. And I like the fact that she went after the big banks, because somebody better go after the big banks, because Barack Obama, a little late than never, is in all of the papers this week trying to get the big banks to be more regulated. I mean, the financial crisis.
He's trying to get Amazon to hire more slaves. I mean, he's on the wrong side of every issue.
Okay, well, let's move on from this. Now, you had another piece that I thought was interesting, fascinating. And
those must be euphemisms for off the mark.
No. This is fascinating. Just tell people about your concierge doctor thing. Oh. Your general practitioner. What happened? This is, I think, the future for all of us, and it's quite scary. Go ahead.
You're not going for an exam later that you're worried about, are you?
No, I'm not. Okay. First of all, thank you for in a sense, raising this. Something very strange happened to me, so that eventually I had to write about it. A couple years ago, I had this wonderful general practitioner, really superb. He sends me a letter saying, if you want me to keep being your doctor, you're going to have to pay me a premium of $1,500 a year on top of your insurance payments. And I just kind of let it go. Like, that was a bad thing that happened to me. I met his successor, if you will, another young, I'd say sort of charismatic, talented young doctor. And then I get a letter from him saying, well, if you like me, you're going to have to pay me an $1,800 premium to remain my patient. On top of your insurance things. And I mean,
concierge.
It's called the concierge practice. I mean, I'm having a big meeting tomorrow. I actually got a lot of feedback on that. A lot of doctors read it. I got completely even feedback.
It's a very complicated. It's not just a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, one of the things is it speaks to how busy the doctors are. and how it's hard to get a good doctor's appointment. And at the same time, what I love in the column that you raised, because what I love about Alex is that you do see that you don't, both all sides, you went ahead and bought something that was as expensive as 2 years of this concierge service.
Yeah.
Like this, but this is what I always think. Like when someone says, well, I can't afford to go get my teeth done because I don't have dental insurance. Hey, I'm going to see Beyonce next week. You know, well, don't buy the tickets.
I couldn't believe it. I couldn't agree with you more. I actually, before I did that column, I did a calculation about what do I spend on, you know, the latte.
Right.
Latte is a famous calculation.
Right.
Kids spend like $18,000 a year in latte. Anyway,
they do.
Yeah.
Right. They should make the coffee
at home.
But
you don't want to buy the extra health.
He bought a rowing shell.
I bought a used rowing shell for $3,400, which would have given me 2 years of super expensive medical care. I mean, I did, you know, as God is, I actually learned some very interesting things writing that column. For instance, you know, most Americans see their doctor 1.7 times a year or something. So, you know, with the numbers, why would, you know, and I literally only saw these guys once or twice a year. I'm a big believer. Slate has a big article this week about why you shouldn't have a physical exam. Okay, wrong. You should have a physical exam. We'll bring the Slate people in here later. But, I mean, yeah, I believe in seeing my doctors. But, you know, $1,800 now, I mean, God forbid you should get sick. Of course, suddenly that rowing shell looks, you kind of wish you hadn't bought it.
You can call them on their cell phone 24/7. Isn't this one of the selling points of concierge medicine? That I will be there for you and you're not going to have to wait 45 minutes, and I'm not going to see you for only 37 seconds. And I'm going to give you the extra tests you want. You may have to pay for those extra tests, but you're going to get top of the line service. That's the concierge argument, is it not?
But you can get your pediatrician to call you back. You can get your veterinarian to call you back. I was shocked about how, you know, I've had the same doctor since I was 15.
Wow.
And she is basically, without having to pay a concierge fee, my concierge doctor. She has basically retired most of her patients because she's getting up there, and she has a handful of patients, and then she does charity work. And she sends me reams of handwritten notes.
That's unusual.
It's amazing. But I would pay for that.
So right. Well, you're very lucky. And I mean, you know, you're very lucky. There's two really interesting sides to this. And I sort of know where I come down. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, it's really important for your internist to know you. And you should, you know, that is invaluable. And I actually come down on the other side of that argument. I mean, I feel like I learned a lot about, I'm perfectly comfortable, you know, I have a lot of confidence in the threshold level of first world medical care, specifically American medical care. So and while I was doing this column, people literally told me stories of how their internist saved their lives. So I get that I'm not necessarily right on this issue, but I'm very comfortable to have entry level access to, I think it's excellent medical care for 80% of Americans.
So did you get the concierge service or not?
No,
you feel very comfortable as a non-concierge patient.
Well, you got to really knock on wood and light candles, right? I mean, many
we'll
candles.
We'll all be dead soon, Alex.
Yeah, but God, you know.
Hopefully not too soon.
But some people need more emotionally. That's the other part of it, which was you sort of answering. You know, if you go in prepared, if you're privileged enough to be born the right way, in the right country, with the right parents, and you're smart enough and don't have a lot of emotional, your doctor's appointment is quick, you get your answer and you leave. You might need more, you know?
Yeah,
and that
there's a big psychological element. All their hypochondriacs obviously follow them into concierge care. I mean, the Wall Street Journal's written about, you know, in Florida, you have like 8 doctor's visits a week.
Do you know Jim Browdy's had about 127 MRIs? It's unbelievable. Yeah. I don't know how he gets away with it. Okay, Alex Beam.
I want to make one more really bizarre
short
point, because Sue raises. And one thing that is changing in a very interesting way, and again, it sounds mildly dangerous, but there's a fair amount of self-diagnosis. I've done this myself with the internet.
Oh, yes.
It sounds
strange.
They
always tell you you have a tumor and you're dying soon.
I learned very early.
It'd be hysterical.
Once I diagnosed my mother, and the doctor said to me, you know, so you're a doctor. And I said, no, I watch a lot of TV. And he got really mad at me. So from now on, I never say that I've done it online. I just ask questions
that have the clues. You've got to use your judgment.
Online is scary.
But Sue mentions this thing. I mean, like, my doctors return my emails. That's a very effective way I don't mind physician's assistants. They're smart.
I love a physician's assistant.
You know,
they're great.
But some people,
I love
nurse practitioners. Yeah, I love them too. God bless them.
All right. Well, now, I know you don't pay any attention to Boston, but just a couple of political questions. You are,
don't
after
ask
all,
me who the mayor is. That's just not. not fair.
I was not going to ask you okay, who the mayor is. Okay, but have you paid any attention at all to the mayor's race in Boston?
Is this like another trick question?
No, it's not a trick question. It is, you know, a major issue coming up in the fall.
I read the paper today. Mr. Somebody got $500,000.
That was John Conley.
People are twisted about it. But don't expect a rational discussion from me.
Okay. Yeah. So is Deval Patrick going to run for president?
Is he? I thought Julia Cayenne was running for president.
She's running for mayor. I'm sorry, she's running for governor. Yeah, well, that's going to be an interesting candidacy because, of course, she was a former columnist of the Boston Globe. She is now on a leave to run for governor. We think she's taken out papers.
This morning she for sure.
She's taking, I think she's still, is she declared? Okay, she's declared. She was a big Homeland Security person. And
she'll keep Massachusetts safe for democracy.
I think Disney should be in charge of Homeland Security. And I know that a woman who's a big FBI head who used to work at Disney and people are very excited. I think Ticketmaster should be in charge of the borders. Because you can never buy tickets like than you're allowed, right? Yeah.
Oh,
so I think Ticketmaster should be in charge of the borders. Disney should be in charge of Homeland Security.
Do you know who many people think is going to run for president?
I don't know. You,
Elizabeth, Jim Brown? Elizabeth Warren, the senator that you think so poorly of.
Maybe well, she's from one of the great nations of America's Midwest, right?
So,
Cherokee Nation.
If it's not Hillary Clinton, it will be, you know, Elizabeth Warren, because Elizabeth Warren is the new kid on the block.
Sounds like GBH pipe dreams to
okay.
me.
Okay, all right. Okay. Now, Alice Beam, when is your next column going to appear in the Boston Globe?
Thank you for asking. God willing, God willing, it's going to appear tomorrow.
What it's about?
You know what?
Give us a preview.
No, I will, because I just wanted to switch signals on people. I think the headline is something like 2.5 cheers for Howard Zinn, because I'm tired of right-wing lunatics dumping on Howard Zinn.
Oh, precisely, the great historian.
Yeah, the way I actually intended to dump on Howard Zinn 3 years ago. And then I bought his book, and
What is the name of the book, the big classic tome of
his? The People's History of the United States.
Matt Damon loves it. His favorite. And it was great. We should all read it.
No, it's just a lot better than it's given credit for being. And so I just, you know, he's they've been sticking pins in him in very just because it's August and there's nothing else to do. And I just wanted to put a piece of the paper saying, you know, be you, lived in Newton, we remember who you are. And then I actually went nuts about a Pulitzer Prize-winning history book that of which I hated every word from beginning. John Meacham's biography of Andrew Jackson, which I thought was just totally scurrilous, false from beginning to end. And I contrasted it with what Howard Zinn wrote about
Andrew
Jackson.
Why was John Meacham scurrilous and false from beginning to end?
Well, yes. Look, Andrew Jackson's an Indian killer, okay? Yeah, he's a genocidal maniac.
Right.
And here's 700 pages under Meacham's pen. He calls him the national pastor of the United States. I'll even give you a line from my column, unless the editors get it. Somewhere in the middle of that column, I write the line, if Andrew Jackson is the national pastor of the United States, I'm the Boston Red Sox middle relief guy. I mean, gag me with a spoon.
Tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, I just hate that. I hate this kind of sentimentalizing about the so-called founding fathers. Yeah. It's not helpful to anyone. And so, you know, half a candle. God bless Zinn for giving us a bit of a counter-narrative, because you're not going to get to the truth without two versions.
You know what I learned? I, of course, can't remember the author's name, but he has a book out that he has fictionalized sort of the early days of during the Civil War, that Frederick Douglass had two white mistresses, and one of whom lived in the house with he and his wife, and that it was just a guy. You know, we just get
scandalous.
Shocking.
We romanticize them, you know, and then it's like he's a man with power. Of course, that's what they did, you know.
Okay, Alex Beam, who used to be called Mr. Fussy, now he's kind of like Mr. Curmudgeon. We would like to see another column about Mr. Fussy. Those are some of my favorites. Alex
Beam got me fired, actually.
it did? Whoops. That's too bad. Alex Beam, thank you for being with us. I love your columns in the Boston Globe.
I miss them terribly
when you're gone. And you have a lot of great books. What's the book you're writing now?
American Crucifixion, coming out in March of 2014.
Okay, and there's another one you've already written about McLean Hospital. What's it called?
Gracefully Insane.
A terrific book. I read every word of it. I loved it.
God bless you.
Thank you, Alex Beam. In the aftermath of the Boston Marathon, nonprofits, businesses, and citizen gardeners are taking on a 26-mile-long landscaping endeavor. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
From From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, there's one thing that helps keep a Marine ready for anything.
Coffee is one of the most important things to Marines. And no matter where you go, you're going to find really, really strong coffee.
Grab a mug. We've got the story of how a couple of Marines launched a project to brew the perfect cup of Joe next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And death in paradise. Though he prefers London drizzle to tropical sunshine, Inspector Poole is determined to turn his team of Caribbean cops into top-notch detectives. Death in Paradise, Wednesday at 9 on WGBH 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Sue O'Connell is filling in for the vacationing Jim Browdy. Diane Valley is one of the organizers and volunteers behind Marathon Daffodils. I read about this just this morning. It made me, gave me a certain lilt in my step. Diane, this is a great, happy, wonderful story. Tell people what you're doing.
We're going to be planting daffodils from Hopkinton to Boston to celebrate the Marathon of 2014. And it was started because last year we did a daffodil day along the Greenway, and it was the day before the marathon. And after the event, the marathon, some of us just felt like this year is going to be a little odd.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like we really do want to honor the victims and the people that were injured. And we wanted to do something to lift the spirits of people that will be running and watching and attending the marathon.
You know, so 26 miles of daffodils from Hopkinton down to Kenmore Square down to Copley Square.
Correct.
That's a lot of daffodils.
Well, at the present time, we're planting 100,000 daffodils, and there's 8 communities.
That's, you know, the daffodil is such a great flower because it's like the crocus, the daffodil, you know, the tulip. You know that spring is coming, that the warm weather is coming. The marathon is firmly in a spot where we'll have daffodils. You know, we don't need to worry about that. Tell me a little bit about the daffodil. Is it a sturdy, you know, flower? Is there some more to it than just the pretty yellow that we see when spring comes?
Well, we're using a Dutch daffodil that has a very big head and it has a good bold look, and it does bloom about the time of the marathon. And for those of us who live through our winters, it's such a cheerful thing to see a daffodil coming up.
Oh, they're great. They're great. You see them in the store, starting around, what, March, I guess, mm-hmm. and you get all excited about this. So you got to get some people to help you. What's the deal? How do people, if people are inspired by what you're talking about and they want to volunteer or they want to donate some money, what do they do, Diane?
Well, we have great partners to do this project. Mm-hmm. We have the Tower Hill Botanic Garden out in Framingham. We have the Massachusetts Horticultural Society. And we have the Town of Brookline. We have Mass Nurserymen. And so we're working with a lot of institutions. They're going to help us reach out to their volunteers. We have the Garden Club Federation. They have 12,700 members, and we have their support. So we think that it will be very good having enough volunteers to come out in October, November, and December to plant. And at this time, we're just trying to raise the $26,000 mm-hmm. so that we can get the daffodils here.
And is there a place people can go or a website or something?
We do have a website.
What is it?
And you can go to marathondaffodils@gmail.com.
Marathondaffodils@gmail.com. Okay.
And we also are using the Cooperative Bank at 201 Main Street in Charlestown, and they are receiving the checks for us.
You know, it's been a great, I don't know if this has been going on for a long time, but I know over at South End News we cover it on a regular basis when the city just asks folks to go out and plant tulips and plant the, are they perennials or annuals? I can never remember which is the ones that come up every year.
Perennials.
And it just really does make such a difference, especially after the winter where it's just dirtier, you know, from the salt, the sand, and just garbage that collects from the wind. And it just really beautifies. Do you have enough land along the way, enough dirt to spots that you're finding to plant?
Well, that's going to be the challenge because, you know, as you know, they have thousands and thousands of runners and spectators. But we have done the route, and there are places along the way, and we will be asking homeowners and businesses to plant along the way so that we want to have enough of an impact so that we can lift people's spirits and brighten their day.
You know, when did daffodils come out?
They come out right about April 15th when the marathon is.
So this is perfect timing. So the plan is to have daffodils lining the entire route from Hopkinton down to Copley Square. You're seeking volunteers. You're seeking some donations. Give people the website and give people the information again if they want to participate. What do they do?
They can get more information at marathondaffodils@gmail.com and send contributions to Marathon Daffodils at the Cooperative Bank at 201 Main Street in Charlestown, Mass.
You know, I also, what I love too is what you've done with the Greenway. There's been a story just about how that space has been sort of unstructured and how beautiful it's come out because it's been unstructured. So you've planted some flowers there too, right?
Right. We planted 13,000 daffodils last fall for spring arrival in 2013 along the North End parks. And it was just such a wonderful enhancement for that space to give some color at that time of year. And it was a very cheerful event. We met people from all over the globe that came to wander through the city. People from South Africa, people from Chicago, people from Kenya. And that's what inspired us to say, well, let's plant some daffodils from Hopkinton to Boston.
I think this is one of the most uplifting, cheerful stories I've heard. You don't often hear good news in the news, and this is very good news. So congratulations to you. It's a wonderful thing you're doing, and I hope you get every dollar you need and every volunteer you need. We should be out there, Sue.
We should be out there. I follow direction well.
Yeah, I don't have much of a green thumb.
No, but
although daffodils, it's really hard to screw those up.
Well, we have master gardeners that will be helping us also.
Okay.
So we are inviting novices to people that are accomplished and from all ages. I mean, we actually planted with very young children, and
it's a
very rewarding experience to have somebody put something in the ground and they take ownership for it. They'll be back in the spring and say, that's mine.
Yeah, great.
I planted that.
Thanks,
Diane. Thank you very much for coming
in.
I much appreciate it. And great luck with your project.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in. Well, did you need scientific research to validate that you feel more empathy for an injured dog than an injured human? Well, in case you did, that study has been conducted, and the findings were presented at a meeting of the American Sociological Association. What this says about humanity is up next on Boston Public Radio.
I'm Philip Martin. I live here, and I report here. Without ever knowing it, you've driven the same routes, passed the same landmarks, and used the same rest stops as today's human trafficking networks.
You know, I think I'm always in reporter mode.
Who's orchestrating this trafficking network from New York to New England?
And it's so important to be aware of the things that are going on in our life and to incorporate that into journalism.
Philip Martin, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers, assisting New England families with the sale of their fine art, antiques, silver, and jewelry since 1988. Located in historic Dedham, Massachusetts, and at GroganCO.com. And Russell's, a family gardening tradition for over 135 years, with annuals, perennials, herbs and shrubs, bird baths, statuary, pots, plus jewelry, gifts, and toys. Russell's Garden Center, Route 20, Wayland.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. Sue O'Connell is here from Bay Windows and South End News, filling in for Jim Browdy. So you open up, say, Bay Windows or South End News. You see some story about a poor dog who's been neglected.
Every week we have
or,
one, yeah.
You know, hurt or run over by a
car.
How
can I help?
And you're beside yourself. You see a sad story about a child, particularly a little tiny baby who's encountered some bad situation. You're in tears.
Awful.
But then you read about the 50-year-old guy who's tortured, abused.
Who cares?
Held in some horrible place. Exactly.
Yeah, who cares?
So if you find yourself feeling more empathy for a dog than you do for an actual grown-up, or more for an infant than you do for somebody 50-plus, you are not alone, as it turns out. Northeastern University sociology professors Jack Levin and Arnold R. Luke have done the scientific research. Jack Levin, whom we usually talk to about serial killers, is here today talking about something else for change. He just presented his findings at the American Sociological Society. Jack, welcome back. Thanks for being on Boston Public Radio.
Thanks, Marjorie.
Well, this kind of fits in the psycho killer kind of model, though, because they say a lot of psycho killers actually or sociopaths like dogs better than they like humans or like animals. So it's sort of in the same vein, isn't it?
Well, you know, you do hear that, but there are also studies that show that men who commit acts of domestic violence against their partners often also will kill the family pet.
Mm.
So it works both ways.
Yeah. So, Jack, the thing, too, that this drives me crazy when I'm on Facebook and I'm watching, you know, some terrible thing has happened in the news to human beings, you know, to people
right. That
we can. And I get the sort of cultural boundaries of relating to people in different countries. You know, I get all that sort of stuff. But, you know, something has happened near us to people we can relate to. And Facebook is filled with, you know, a puppy is missing. You know, or a dog has been mistreated and we have to save this pit bull. And I'm not against that, but it drives me crazy that we don't show the same amount of empathy and sympathy and desire to help as we do to humans.
You know, I think we've become desensitized to the worst kinds of violence against adults. If you stop to think about what we did with Newtown, 20 first graders were killed in this random attack by Adam Lanza in December. And for 6 months, all the cable television programs and the news outlets were filled bumper to bumper with news about Newtown and Sandy Hook. I think, you know, we see young children, we see puppies as very vulnerable, as helpless. We don't see that with adults. They can protect themselves. And anyway, we've spent huge amounts of time in the media discussing violence against adults. I think we've become numb.
Well, you know what? I wondered, Jack Levin from Northeastern University, too, that one of the things we do with adults is we blame them in some fashion for what happened to them. They were walking on the street at midnight, so that's why they got robbed.
Or
they
would never happen to me, the other part of that,
yeah,
the other side of that.
They were driving too fast. I mean, to separate ourselves, to say, oh, exactly what Sue just said, that would never happen to me. And
right. And
we don't blame puppies or infants for what happens to them.
Or we don't blame full-grown adult dogs, because they're just large puppies.
Right, right.
And I think your point is well taken. We see, we don't blame the victim, because puppies and infants and dogs in general are seen as innocent.
Right.
We don't see adults as innocent.
So how did you do this study? Did you put, like, a puppy in distress in one room, and then a human in the other who fell down?
You know, you might have been able to get away with that 30 years ago, but, you know, there's a human subjects committee, and they include dogs in that, but I don't think we would be able to do it. But instead, we gave 240 students at Northeastern a newspaper article. It was fictitious, but they didn't know that. It was about someone or something that got victimized in a brutal attack on the streets. And we just varied whether the victim was a one-year-old puppy or an infant, a one-year-old. Wait a minute. I don't know whether we said one-year-old puppy, actually. A puppy, a one-year-old infant, a six-year-old dog, or a 30-year-old adult, human. So the only thing that differed in these four different newspaper articles was the age and the species of the victim. And, you know, one-fourth of the students got one of those. And the difference was incredibly dramatic. You know, these students were a lot more distressed when the victim was a puppy or an infant or a six-year-old dog, a lot more distressed than they were when the victim was a 30-year-old adult human.
Well, you know, the other thing that I'm thinking of right now is that the puppy will appreciate you saving him. And the baby, although not able to express it that way, it's a very simple transaction, you know, societal
right.
transaction that happens. Where if you rescue someone on the street, they may, who knows what's going on with them? They may not be happy to be rescued. So it's a very simple transaction.
Well, you know, I think that is also a very good point. And I think we really didn't answer that question. We found out that these differences happen. We see that age trumps species in many cases, but we really don't understand why. That's the next study. Is it vulnerability? Is it innocence? Is it that we might feel embarrassed intervening in an accident or a crime scene and find out that we're not wanted when it's an adult? So I think you're right, and those are the kinds of questions that we still have to answer.
We're talking with Jack Levin from Northeastern University. He and his colleague Arnold R. Luke have found that we are, grown-up people, or as students in this case at Northeastern, are more empathetic toward dogs and infants than adult human beings. Why'd you do this, Jack?
Well, you know, this is one of a series of studies that Arnie R. Luke and I have conducted over the last several years. We really were looking originally at the link between animal cruelty and human violence. And in one study we did, we found that that individuals who abuse animals are five times more likely than those who don't abuse animals of committing acts of human violence. It's called the link. I mean, it's a relationship that many people are now studying. And we also found, by the way, that the real factor, it's not just any kind of animal abuse that is linked or connected to human violence later on in life. It's really mostly sadistic, intimate, up close and personal beating, or in other ways injuring or killing.
I don't even want to think about it.
Well,
it's too upsetting.
Except, let me just finish that one. A long
I prefer
sentence.
To talk about serial killers.
Well,
go ahead.
You know, actually, most serial killers have rehearsed what they do with dogs and cats. So, you know, there are lots of people, healthy people, who've abused animals as children, and they grow up and out of it.
George Bush, didn't he put like firecrackers and frogs or something like that?
That's what I
second,
heard.
The second President Bush.
Oh, yeah,
I think he conceded it somewhere. Barbara looked away, and all of a sudden there was George going after the frogs.
That's right. But I think what we should be doing is focusing a lot more on sadistic abuse that's aimed at dogs and cats, because that does seem to be a pattern that we find in killers later on.
You know, two last things I wondered, Jack Levin. One, are people more empathetic toward puppies or babies, or is it about the same?
I found
no difference.
Significant
okay.
difference.
Depends on if they're on the plane. If they're on a plane.
That's right. And you also pointed out that women are more empathetic in general than men. Why is that?
You know, women are more empathetic in general to suffering. You know, they're the ones who give birth. They're still responsible more than men for child rearing. They enter the helping professions, social work, nursing traditionally, and now they dominate in veterinary medicine and even in medical schools generally. So women are helping, and I think part of it might be biological, but I think a large part of it is learned as well.
Jack Levin from Northeastern University. It is kind of nice not to be talking to you about serial killers.
Oh, Marjorie, you're not kidding.
Just puppies.
Well,
just puppies.
Yeah, but you don't like to think about puppies in distress. But there's a certain fascination, I regret to say,
with serial killers. Next week, my wife and I are bringing home a puppy.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
What kind?
It's called a Khotan.
What's that?
I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll have a close eye on you, Jack. We're going to be keeping track. Jack Levin is the Irving and Betty Brudnick Professor of Sociology and Criminology at Northeastern University. He and his colleague Arnold Arluck have found that we're more empathetic toward dogs and infants than adult human beings. We're opening up the phone lines for you to join us and share your experiences. 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. We want to hear from you on Boston Public Radio.
I love Jack Levin. He's wonderful. He writes all about serial killers, but this is a little bit different for him, and I totally buy it 100%. Now, you're in newspapers.
Yes,
I'm in newspapers.
Yes.
Okay, as you said, you run a story about a dog in distress. People are hysterical.
Crazy. Dogs
They're
getting electrocuted
up.
In the South End, remember, on the manhole?
On the manhole covers.
A boy had been shot by a passerby, totally innocent kid, was shot. We did a front page story on it. We did a story on the manhole cover, the dogs that were getting electrocuted. People were most outraged by the manhole cover dog.
Oh, yeah. They had hearings down
Drove
at City
me
Hall.
Crazy.
I remember going to those hearings at City Hall where some of the dogs did survive, thank God.
No, and it's a terrible
a lot
thing,
of them didn't.
But it's not as terrible as a young man being shot to death.
It was assault, by the way, on the manhole covers
in
the snow in the wintertime. The poor dogs were walking in the salt, and they got. And I remember going to movies. I remember going to that movie Old Yeller when I was a kid. And remember they kill Old Yeller at the end? And I remember standing up in the theater and screaming, don't kill him.
Part of it is
my babysitter
that,
was
is that
mortified.
What happens? That
they
you,
kill
you,
him.
You spoiled it for
couldn't
me.
Couldn't watch
Latt.
Well,
it.
It's an old movie.
No,
I couldn't
kidding.
Watch Lassie. That was too distressing. Remember Lassie?
You know,
the theme song. Can you sing a few bars from the theme song
I can't
song
remember
Lassie?
It, but I know that he's in the well. Go save him in the well. He's in the well.
Yeah,
Lassie
was
go
in the well.
No, the kid was in the well. Lassie had to save him.
Because dogs can really dog paddle. There's nothing cuter than watching your dog paddle.
I think part of it really is, I don't even think you need to do the study. I think it's just that, you know, your dog is always forgiving. You know, cats not so much, but dogs, you can yell at your dog for doing something wrong, which they can't even remember what it was that they did wrong.
I hope you don't yell at your dog.
Oh, I yell at my dog eats tissues. Okay? It's worth yelling at.
That's disgraceful, yelling at your dog.
But, you know, the dog forgets and just is happy to see you again. Babies are the same way. Yep. So you know you're going to get a positive reaction. I once helped somebody who fell fell off the curb and she started hitting me, you know? She just was, she fell. I went to pick her up. She hit me, gave me one of those old lady backhands.
It might not be too much fun rescuing pit bulls. They might have the same kind of reaction.
No,
our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. So is it okay that we feel more empathy towards dogs than we do toward 30-year-olds? Should we go into therapy for this? Is this just human nature? Do you feel this way? I know I feel this way. I must admit it. I do feel this way. And why do we feel this way? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Molly from Providence, what do you think about this, Molly?
Hi. Well, I just wanted to bring up your earlier point, Marjorie, in that you weren't sure if an adult person would actually want to be helped in a situation where you think they might be being injured or something like that. I had an experience where that actually happened. It was a few years ago. I was in downtown Providence with some friends leaving a club around midnight, and there was a man. We heard some yelling, and there was a man holding a woman up by her neck against the chain link fence and beating on her, basically. It was horrible. So I actually flagged down a passing police officer while my male friend approached them and tried to get the guy to stop beating the girl. He punched my friend.
Yep.
We were surrounded by cops. And then the girl starts screaming, saying, don't arrest him, I love him.
Well,
after
that's
he
the whole,
had literally
the battered woman
syndrome. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I don't think that's an awful story.
But Molly, how about when you're looking through the newspaper, you know, when you see terrible things happening, and I make the connection to it's people like you, because I understand sometimes when people see things happen to people in other countries or different cultures, they don't feel the same, you know, kind of connection. But do you feel worse when you see something happen to a dog in the newspaper?
Personally, I'm very empathetic, so I feel no matter what it is, no matter if it's a 60-year-old man or an infant or a puppy, whatever it is, I always feel something.
Well, good
and
for
it's
you.
Kind of I feel very intensely sometimes my own dismay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, I'm just one of those people that I care about everything and everyone. So personally,
you need to meditate, Molly. Molly, you need to do a little meditation.
Well, does that help you not care about people that get
stressed?
No, not help,
but you do get overwhelmed. Oh. I mean, you know, you and I, Marjorie, too, in the news business, we see all this bad news all the time, and it really can be, it
Molly,
weighs on you.
Thank you for the call. You know what? One of the things Jack Lemmon did not mention in this piece, but I think it's true too. I think human nature is to tend to feel badly or more bad, I should say. Is that correct? More bad?
Whatever.
Worse. Worse. For old people.
Yeah.
I mean, if you see an old person being hurt, you feel much differently because, again, it's how much, kind of helpless.
Well, how much responsibility do they have to the problem, which is the sort of other subtext of this.
I hated that in the movies, too. I could never watch movies about old people or dogs.
Do you remember when you first became a parent? This happened to me. As soon as I became a parent, I couldn't watch any of the SVU episodes, the Law & Order episodes that had kids, bad things happening to kids.
Oh, yeah.
I used to love them. And then as soon as it happened, I said, I can't watch any of these.
It's hormones. Run wild. I think that's what it is.
Well, I adopted. Do you think it was still
adopted?
Hormones?
I think it's, vicarious hormones or something like that.
That could be our new study.
Don't you get hormones? I think you get hormones when you adopt.
Yeah, you do, actually. You do.
Sarah from Newton, what do you think about feeling worse for the cats, for the dogs, than you do for the real people?
Well, good afternoon, first
Hi.
Of all. And I actually will probably reiterate what Molly had just said. I don't know whether I feel equally, whether I feel worse or less about anybody who is weaker and doesn't have the strength to fight back. And when you look at somebody who feels that need to be bigger and fatter and everything like that, and the only thing that I would disagree with Dr. Levin about, who I absolutely love.
He's great.
He is wonderful. Is that I think that when he said that, I think women aren't empathetic for the reasons why he said. I think we recognize the fact that we are potentially in the same danger.
You have just hit the nail on the head. I think I think that there's two factors. I was thinking the same thing, and I think that's exactly the point that women. We're in danger a lot of the time. You know, there's a possibility of something bad happening to us. Plus, I think we pay more attention. You know, I think.
Oh yeah.
You know, with the when you're parenting, even if you have two equally involved parents, one male, one female. It's the female who's going to notice that the kid's arm is broken before, the dads are often
oblivious.
And I don't think it's because they don't care. I think it's mostly because of a difference of paying attention to danger.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Could I add one thing?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
And not just to hype my husband. the both of us constantly tell her, listen to yourself.
Right.
Listen to listen to what's inside. And you are just as smart. You are just as strong. Unfortunately, in a lot of ways, we're just not as tough.
That's it.
Sarah, thank you very much for the call. A couple of good emails here. I was talking about Lassie before, how I couldn't watch the Lassie because Timmy was always falling in the well. There's a great short story, apparently, by T. I can never pronounce the middle initial. Boyle is
it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's called Heart of a Champion, in which Lassie, tired of forever rescuing that klutz Timmy, is tempted to take up with a mangy coyote. Have you read that story?
No, I haven't, but I can understand. That Timmy was always in trouble.
And Scott emails that he's run a dog walking business for 10 years. Dogs are loving, loyal, and consistent, and people. And then Scott uses a naughty word that I'm not going to appear on the
radio. I'm going to get people a little riled up here. You notice how cats aren't in this study.
Cats are not – well, because cats take you or leave you.
Yeah, and people know that.
Yeah,
I don't think they feel the same way about cats as they do about dogs. I have this kind of weird, bigoted feeling about cats. Like, you know how some people are bigots about the greater group but not about individuals?
Yeah.
Like, I hate all cats except the ones I know.
David from Providence. What do you think, David? We only have a few seconds left, so make it quick, David. What's up?
Hey, I'm just driving into the vet right now with my puppy who came down with something last night. I was listening to the show. I couldn't believe lying on the floor with my fiance last night around our whimpering dog. I was thinking to myself, well, neither one of us gets sick. We kind of like give each other a Gatorade in the morning and say, good luck, we'll see you after work. When the puppy's sick, we're like out of the bed.
Yeah.
Make sure. So, I mean, it's unbelievable. I really think it is. It's just kind of this dog relies on you for everything. And all of a sudden on the chart, you don't know what to do. So the empathy level, you know, really skyrockets there. It's just funny. It was such perfect timing to listen to the conversation.
How old is your puppy, David?
She's 9 months, and I'm hoping it's a pinched nerve or a pulled muscle.
Oh, what kind of dog?
It's a half boxer, half lab.
Marjorie's welling up here.
Well,
you know?
I do. I get very upset about dogs.
You would tell your wife to go sleep on the couch if she was sniffling too much. She'd be like, oh, honey, go. Here's a box of tissues. I'll see you in the morning. But
I
bet you slept with the dog last night, didn't you?
Yes, he probably did.
Yeah.
He probably did.
He did.
It's like watching 101 Dalmatians. You know, you can't really watch it too many times without just breaking down repeatedly.
True.
But the
true.
Tragedy of those little puppies and Cruella de Vil is one of the worst human beings ever born. Okay, that is it for us today. Sue O'Connell has been graciously filling in for Jim Browdy all week long. Peter Katz of WGBH is with me tomorrow, and Jim is going to be back next week. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Also tomorrow, we have open mic with Christopher Lydon with his tribute to the great writer Al Murray, who died last week. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. She's Sue O'Connell. Thank you again for tuning in to Greater Boston Public Radio.